Osho. The sun rises in the evening. Talks on Zen. Discourse number 1. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Bhagwan, do you not see him, the really wise man, always at ease, unmoved? He does not get rid of illusion, nor does he seek for the so-called truth. Ignorance is intrinsically the Buddha nature, our illusory unreal body, the cosmic body. Getting rid of things and clinging to emptiness is an illness of the same kind. It is just like throwing oneself into a fire to avoid being drowned. When asked, "What is your religion?" I answer, "The power of the Mahayana," sometimes affirming things, sometimes denying them. It is beyond the wisdom of man. Sometimes with common sense, sometimes against it. Heaven cannot make head or tail of it.
I have seen the sun rising in the evening, and since then I have been drunk with that which is. You can call it God, you can call it Nirvana, you can call it any name. It does not matter. Whether you give it a name or you don't give it, it remains the same. A rose is a rose is a rose. But one thing is certain about it, that the sun rises in the evening. The apparent is not real. The real is just the opposite of the apparent. It is obvious that the sun rises in the morning. To deny the apparent and the obvious, I say that I have seen the sun rising in the evening. The experience of the Buddhas contradicts the experience of everyone else. It is not common. It is unique. It is extraordinary. Ordinarily, whatsoever we have become accustomed of knowing, it's just a mind game. Because we look at that which is with loaded eyes. Our mirrors are covered with great dust. They have become incapable of reflecting the real. The real is not far away. The real surrounds. You are part of it. It is part of you. You are not separate from it. You have never been separate from it. You cannot be separate from it. There is no way to be separate from it. It is impossible to be separate from it. But still, the dust-covered mirror is incapable of reflecting it. Once the dust disappears, you will be surprised that all that you have been seeking was not needed to be sought at all, because you had it already. The spiritual search is as illusory as any other search. The search itself is illusory, because it has taken one thing for granted, that something is missing, and nothing is missing. Once you take it for granted that something is missing, you start looking for it. Then you go on searching for it in all directions, and the more you search, the more you will miss it. Because the more you search, the more dust covered becomes the mirror. The more you travel to seek it, the farther and farther you go in search of it, the more and more frustrated you become. Slowly, slowly, you start thinking that it is so far away, that's why I'm not reaching to it. The reality is just the opposite. You are not reaching it because you are it. It is not far away. It is so close by. Even to call it close is not right, because even closeness is a kind of distance. It is not distant at all. It breathes in you. It is not there, it is here. It is not then, it is now. It has always been with you from the very beginning. Everyone is a Buddha. Everyone is a mirror, capable of reflecting. This is the basic message of Zen, and the greatest message that has ever been delivered to man, and the greatest liberating force that has ever been brought to the earth. But you will have to look in a totally new way. All that is needed is not search, but a new way of looking at things. The common, the ordinary, the usual way has to be dropped. Hence I say again, the sun rises in the evening. By what name you call it does not matter a bit, because it is worldless. It is worldlessness. It is utter silence. It is unchanging, unmoving. It is eternal. It is timeless. We are going into an immense journey with Yoga Daishi, a great Zen master. These sutras are known as Sodoka, the Song of Enlightenment. When Yoga became enlightened, he burst forth singing. Just like a tree in a spring bursts forth blooms, and thousands of flowers are there, and great fragrance. This is a song remember, it has not been addressed to any ideals. That is the beauty of it. If somebody has heard it, that is another thing. But yoga has not addressed it. He was simply singing it. Out of the sheer joy that has happened in him. In fact, to say that he was singing it is not right. It was singing itself in him. Just as we say, it is raining. Like that, it was singing. And that is true of all the people who have become enlightened. The ideas, if it is there, is secondary. It is not primarily an address. It has not to take into account the people who are hearing it. They are irrelevant. Maybe they trigger the process. But there is no compromise. Just because of this, many people have felt, particularly R.H. Blitt, who has translated this beautiful song into English. He says that yoga keeps on talking when he has nothing more to say. That is true. One rose flower is enough to say what the rose bush has to say. 1,000 flowers are not needed. But the rose bush is overflowing. You don't go to the rose bush. You don't criticize the rose bush. You don't say that why you go on repeating. It is enough to say by one flower, your message has been seen and heard. The second flower will be just like the first. And so on and so forth. R.H. Blitt is logically right. He says, yoga goes on talking when he has nothing more to say. It is not a question whether one has to say more or less. Deep down, he has nothing to say at all. He is not saying anything. It is just sheer joy. Hence it is called the song. It is not meant to be heard. If it is heard, that is another matter. When the rose bush blooms and you see the flower and the beauty and the benediction that surrounds it and you are thrilled, that is another matter. The rose bush had never thought about you. If you had not passed by, there would have been no difference. The rose bush would have continued singing its song. So is the case with me. You are just an occasion. I go on singing my song. It is unaddressed. It is a flowering. I have also nothing to say. Certainly I have something to sow, but nothing to say. So is the case with yoga. Blitt missed the point. But I can understand why he missed it. The logical mind always misses it. Because yoga goes on repeating the same thing again and again. The statements are circular. They are the same kind of flowers, again and again and again. They don't say more. They don't add anything new. But the joy is such, the explosion is such, that one is simply overflowing with it. Yoga cannot do anything about it. He is utterly helpless. Just as the rose bush is utterly helpless. In fact, the rose bush is not doing anything. Yoga is not doing anything. He is as much a witness to his song as you are. He may be himself feeling a little puzzled why this song goes on and on and on. I have said it. I have said it many times. But what to do if the song continues? If it is coming from the very source of existence, yoga cannot prevent it. And this is one of the most significant things to be understood. Otherwise, you will misunderstand all the Buddhas. Gautama, the Buddha has been misunderstood because for 40 years continuously he was saying the same thing. Why? He could have said in very few words. Those words can be written on a postcard. But you have missed the point. You have not seen the sheer joy of sharing, of just singing it for its own sake. Remember, this is a song, the song of enlightenment. It is flowing through yoga. Yoga is just a vehicle, a passage. A hollow bamboo. Existence itself is singing through him. He cannot do anything this way or that. There is no point in criticizing poor yoga. Once a man came to Jai Krishnamurti and asked, "Why you go on talking?" And at the same time you go on saying it cannot be said. And he said, "Ask the rose. Ask the trees. Why they go on blooming? There is no why to it. There is nobody doing it. The doer has disappeared. Hence the song has become possible. Yoga is no more. Yoga and the song both cannot exist together. If the yoga exists, then the song cannot exist. The song can exist only when the first condition has been fulfilled, that the yoga has disappeared, when he is no more there, when he is no more obstructing the passage, when he is absolutely empty, only then God can take possession of him." Zen people don't use the word God. They use the word Buddha nature. But it is the same. One is possessed. The song has to be sung. The dance has to be danced. It is not your dance. It is not my dance. It is nobody's dance. Existence itself dances. Yoka Daishi was one of the disciples of the great Huineng, the sixth patriarch of Zen. When he came to the masters, he was just on the verge of enlightenment, as everybody is, just on the verge. If you understand it, only one step and you are enlightened, or not even one step, just a blink. When Yoka came to his master, the scriptures say he was just on the verge of enlightenment. And I say to you, everybody else is just the same on the verge. You can postpone it as long as you want, but postponement is yours. That is your decision. You can postpone it forever. That is your freedom. Otherwise, you are always on the threshold. You have always been on the threshold. Any moment you could have become enlightened. Any moment you can become enlightened. Nobody is barring the path except your own decision. But he was a unique man. Unique in the sense that he was not ready to postpone any longer. When he came to Huineng, only a little, just a gentle push was enough. He had slept long. The sleep was disappearing. Just he was in a state when you are not asleep and not awake. And just a small dialogue with the master. Just a small exchange. A little encounter. And he became enlightened. With no effort. With no method. Just looking into the eyes of the master, few words pass between the master and the yoga. And the dialogue is of immense significance. I would like you to understand it. In fact, I would like you to have such an exchange with me. Yoka Daishi walked around the master three times without bowing and merely shook his Buddhist staff with iron rings. The master said, a Sramana, a Buddhist monk, embodies the 3,000 rules of deportment and the 80,000 minute moral rules. From whence does your honor come, may I ask, with your overweening self-assurance? When one comes to a master, one has to bow three times. That has been a traditional greeting. When you face an enlightened being, you have to bow three times. The body bows, the mind bows, the soul bows. You surrender utterly. That is just a gesture. It happens spontaneously. And when it happens spontaneously, only then it happens. Just two, three nights before, Hema came to see me. she may not be even aware of the Buddhist rules, that when you face the master, you have to bow down 3 times. She bowed 3 times. She was laughing all the time, because what was happening? She could not understand it. She was puzzled. She must have felt a little ridiculous. And everybody else started laughing. But something had taken possession of her being. Now this is not a formality. What happened to Hema was a natural outpouring, a spontaneity. But in this ugly world, every spontaneous thing becomes reduced into a formality. It used to happen to people when they will come to see a Buddha, they will bow down 3 times. Then people started following, imitating. In the first meeting with the master Huineng, Yoka walked around the master 3 times without bowing and merely shook his Buddhist staff with iron rings. And the master said, a Sramana embodies the 3000 rules of deportment and the 80,000 minute moral rules. Now look what happens to religion. Buddha has said that be a law unto yourself, be a lamp unto yourself. There is no other law. But Buddhist scriptures are full of rules, 3000 rules of deportment. Even to remember them is very difficult. And 80,000 minute rules. And a Buddhist monk is expected to fulfill all of them. Huineng said, from where does your honor come? May I ask, with your overweening self-assurance? Do you think Huineng was saying that you have to follow all these rules? No, not at all. He was simply provoking. This is the push. He was hitting harsh. He was hitting at this new arrival who is just on the verge, as everybody else is. You can misunderstand it, then you have postponed your enlightenment. Yoka could have retorted back that what nonsense. One has to be spontaneous. And I have never thought that a man like you will expect those stupid rules, 30,000 or 80,000. He could have retorted and missed. Yoka replied, birth and death is a problem of great moment. All changes ceaselessly. Looks unrelated. It is not. He is saying, any moment I can die. Do you want me to follow all that ritual, 80,000 rules? And if I die, following those 80,000 rules, then who will be responsible? Who will be responsible for my misery, for my rebirth into misery again? You or I? He has not said that. He simply indicates. It is a beautiful answer. Birth and death is a problem of great moment. And we are not certain even of the next moment. how can I go into those rules? But he has not said so much. He has simply indicated why he is not following all those rules. All changes ceaselessly. Everything is a flux. I can die any moment. If you say, I will bow down as many times as you say. But if I die in the middle of it, without becoming enlightened, you will be responsible, sir. He had changed the label. The master has pushed, and he has rightly responded. The master asked, why not embody the unborn and grasp the timeless? Why be worried about death and birth? Another push. Another provoking. Another temptation. Why not embody the unborn? Why don't you think yourself that there is no death, that the soul is immortal, that life never dies? Everybody else believes like that. Why don't you believe like that? Embody the unborn and grasp the timeless. Why be worried with time and flux and change? Grasp the eternal. Yoga replied, to be unborn and deathless is to embody it. To be timeless is to grasp it. There is no other way. How can I grasp it? How I can embody the unborn and the deathless? It is not a question of belief. It is not a question of practice either. I cannot cultivate it, because all that is cultivated will be false. False because it is cultivated. It will be imposed. How I can embody it and how can I grasp the timeless? There is only one way, and that is to be. And I am not yet. I have not seen it yet. I have heard all these philosophies. I can believe in them. Millions of people are believing in them. But belief never leads to knowing. Only being is needed. And I am not yet self. I am not yet deathless. I don't know. All that I know is death. All that I know is time. And what you are saying to me, should I believe? How can I embody the deathless? Unless I know that I am death. To be unborn and deathless is to embody it. That's the only way. To be timeless is to grasp it. That is so. That is so, assented the master. The push has worked. The master could not provoke him into any nonsense. The temptation was given. The master could not succeed in tempting him. Otherwise, the easy way, the way of least resistance would have been that he would have fallen in the trap. But he remained out of it. Huining said, that is so. That is so. At this, Yoga acted according to the prescribed ceremonies and prostrated himself. Now see the beauty of it. Now it is happening spontaneously. No, it is not something formal. It is of the heart. It is of the being itself. The moment the master says, that is so, that is so. This affirmation from the master's side and great reverence arose in him. Not a traditional reverence. Not anything of the head and the concept. Not that he is enlightened, he has heard, so he has to bow down. In this moment when the master said, with his grace, he sours in his affirmation on this new arrival. The heart moved. There was a contact. This is real meeting. The master has found his disciple and the disciple has found his master. Immediately, that which has been prescribed in the scriptures happened on its own, not according to the prescription, not because of the prescription, but because of some real encounters. At this yoga acted according to the prescribed ceremonial and prostrated himself. See the difference. The difference is great. You go to somebody, you have heard he is a great sage, and you bow down. If it is only because you have heard that he is a great sage, then you are not bowing down really. In fact, you are bowing down to the people who have said that he is a sage, not to him. You are a victim of a propaganda. You have been conditioned by the public opinion. You are bowing down to the public. Your bowing down has nothing to do with this person, this real person. When you look into the eyes and you find the sage there, and not according to your ideas, because you may have certain ideas how a sage should be. If according to your ideas a person is a sage and you bow down, you are bowing down to yourself. You are paying respect to your own self. You are patting your own back. You are saying to yourself, how true I am. This is what I have always thought a sage should be, and here is a sage who is a proof that my thinking is right. It is self-enhancing, ego-enhancing. But when you really look into the eyes of a sage, you feel his energy. You make yourself available to his being, and something moves in the heart, and suddenly you find yourself bowing down. That is a totally different matter. Not of this world, not earthly, it is divine. That is the meeting of a master and a disciple. That is true initiation. At this yoga acted according to the prescribed ceremonial and prostrated himself, then soon after bade farewell to the master. Are not you in a bit of a hurry to be off? Immediately he bowed down, prostrated, and said, now, thank you for all that you have done to me. I must leave now. The master said, are not you in a bit of a hurry to be off? Yoka replied, motion has no real existence. So how can there be such a thing as hurry? another encounter. No, it starts from the side of the disciples. The master is happy. He has assented. He has said, that is so, that is so. One part is fulfilled. But the dialogue, to be total, has to have another part too. Now the disciple provokes the master. He says, motion has no real existence. It is all relative. So says the modern physics. Buddhism has always been saying so. Modern physics agrees in many points with Buddha's intuition. In fact, modern physics is almost Buddhistic. If there is going to be any meeting between science and religion ever, it will happen between Buddhism and science, through Buddhism and science. Christianity lags far behind, looks almost childish. So is Judaism. So is Islam. Hinduism comes a little closer. Jainism a little more closer. But Buddhism is just parallel. Whatsoever modern science has discovered has been discovered by Buddha 25 centuries before. Of course, in a different language it has been expressed. It is not the language of mathematics. It is the language of poetry. But the message is the same, that poetry can be translated into mathematics. Motion has no real existence. So how can there be such a thing as a hurry? The master said, who knows that motion is unreal? If motion is unreal, then the knower of it cannot be real. Who knows? Who is the witness of it? If the dream is unreal, the dreamer cannot be real. When the dream is found to be unreal, the dreamer is also found to be unreal. They disappear together, they appear together. They are aspects of the same coin. If motion is unreal, the master says, then who knows? Who is this declaring motion to be unreal or relative? Yoka said, you yourself are discriminating in asking such a question. You ask me why in such a hurry. You discriminated. You created time by your question. I am simply being polite in answering you. You are the cause of it. The master was immensely happy and exclaimed, you have grasped worthlessness splendidly. Because if one can know, one can see that time is unreal, then birth and death both have disappeared. Because they exist in time, they are events in time. If time itself is unreal, then birth and death disappear. This is liberation. And that's what happens in deep meditation. You come to see that time is unreal. The moment mind stops, time stops. They stop together. Hence Buddhists say, mind is time. They are synonymous. They are two names for the one phenomenon. It is the movement of the time that creates the movement of the time. It is the moving mind that creates the illusion of a moving time. Once the mind stops, is in utter silence, thoughts disappear and nothing is moving, all time disappears. Each time you penetrate into meditation, time stops, the clock stops, the world stops. Then you are neither in the past nor in the future, nor even in the present. You simply are. There is no time. You cannot relate yourself with time. So the best definition of meditation is a state of no time or a state of no mind. The master said, you have dressed birthlessness splendidly. But yoga remarks again, has the expression of worthlessness any meaning whatever? If there is no time, there is no birth. If there is no birth, what is the meaning of birthlessness? All meanings depend on their opposites. If somebody asks you what is light, you will have to bring darkness in to define it. If somebody asks you what is health, you will have to bring disease in to define it. All words have meaning in context to their opposites. If birth does not exist, what is the meaning of birthlessness? Yoga attacks again. He could not provoke the master the first time. He wanted to drag the master into a debate. But you cannot drag the master into a debate. He is not there to fight. He is not there to argue. That's why he assents happily, you have grasped worthlessness splendidly. This is no way to argue. Argument means even if you are not right, even if you see that you are not right, go on insisting that you are right and the other is wrong. Argument is an ego trip, an ego number. You cannot argue with the master because there is nobody. You can have a dialogue with the master but no argument. Whenever he will see the point that you have come close to truth, he will immediately affirm it. He will say, this is so, that's so. You are right. It is not a question who is right. The question is always what is right. See the difference. When you are discussing with somebody, it is never the question of truth. The question is, who is right, I or you? You will come across Buddhist scriptures of so many instances like this. And sometimes you will have the feeling, a great dialogue, a great discussion, a great argument is going to set in. And if you are accustomed of reading Western books, the dialogues of Plato, where Socrates goes on and on arguing and arguing, you will expect something like that, but you will be frustrated, because with a master, the moment anything comes closer to truth, he immediately affirms, whether it comes from you or from anybody else, that doesn't matter. Truth matters. From whom it is coming is irrelevant. It is not an ego conflict. Yoka wanted to drag the master. He wanted to test the master, to examine whether he is really found a sage or it is just an illusion. The man has tremendous beauty, grace, has eyes of great depth, has great love energy around him. But one should be cautious. All these things may be just cultivated. If one practices long enough, things almost start looking as if they are real. So again he says, has the expression worthlessness any meaning whatever? The master counters, if it had no meaning, how could anybody discriminate? We can discriminate only if there is meaning in words. If there is no meaning in words, then there is no possibility of any discrimination. Then you cannot say this is day, and then you cannot say this is night. How you will discriminate if there is no meaning in words? If words are just meaningless, then no discrimination is possible. Yoka said, discrimination also has no meaning. He goes on insisting, deeper and deeper. He wants to see whether the master becomes angry, whether the master says something which shows that all this sageness is just cultivated. The master was so happy. He laughed. He pulled Yoka close to him. He blessed him and exclaimed, very good indeed. This is a strange dialogue. What do you feel in this unique dialogue? What is its uniqueness? It is unique because here are two men of infinite power facing each other without any competition. Two men of truth facing each other without any argument. This only happens when the power is real. Only real power is capable of accepting the truth of the other. When the power is not real, you are always defending. You are afraid. You may be exposed. When the power is not real, you move cautiously. You cannot say the other is right, because then you are wrong. When the power is unreal, it is always ego power. The real power is not yours. The real power is of the whole, of the total. This only happens when the power is real. Real power means pure power, not over others. This distinction has to be understood. There are two kinds of power in the world. One is power over others. That is what political power is. Kings have it, and the politicians and the dictators. But it is impotent. Deep down, it is poor. They are hiding something, their impotence, in the clamor of power. They are just creating the power around themselves so that they need not face their impotence. The religious power, the spiritual power, is not power over others. It is simply power. It is just pure power. It has no reference to the others. That's why it can be so humble, so innocent. The pure power is that the sages have preeminently, and what the politicians and the dictators are most lacking in. That's why I say again and again that politics and religion are diametrically opposite. A politician cannot be religious. It is intrinsically impossible. A religious person cannot be a politician. That too is intrinsically impossible. They move into different kinds of power. One is power over others, the other is simply emptiness inside, and the power is God. It descends in you. Because you are empty, you become full of it. The power over others is destructive. The pure power is pure creativity. Before we enter the sutras, few things to be noted. Hubert Benoit calls Zen the doctrine abrupt, as opposing to all others which he names progressive doctrines. For the first, for Zen, he uses the singular, and for the others he uses the plural. Because the doctrine abrupt can only be one. But the progressive doctrines can be as many as there are people. Each one has to progress in his own way. So progressive doctrines can be millions. He is right in using plural for it. And the abrupt doctrine can only be one. It can't be different for different people. Because it is abrupt, it doesn't depend on you, who you are. It depends only on one thing, that you disappear. And the disappearance is abrupt, sudden. This point has to be understood, because that is very fundamental to Zen. Yoga is a progressive doctrine. Zen, the doctrine abrupt. That's its fundamental vision of great beauty and grandeur. It simply means one thing, that Buddhahood is not something to be attained. In yoga, the samadhi has to be attained. You have to improve upon yourself. You have to go on and on working on yourself. It is a great program of improvement, of achievement, of accomplishment. In Zen, all that you have to find is that you are already a Buddha. That there is no accomplishment, that there is no growth that there is no attainment. That Buddhahood is everybody's inner nature. Everybody is a Buddha. Whether you know it or not makes no difference. Few Buddhas are fast asleep and snoring. Few Buddhas have become awakened. But both are Buddhas. In Zen there is no method. Not that Zen masters don't give methods to their disciples. They give. They give methods only to prove to you, to your heart's desire and contentment, that all methods are useless. They give methods so that you work on the methods and slowly, slowly you see the futility of it. The moment you see the futility of one method, with that you are finished. Higher method is given to you. And so on and so forth, higher and higher methods will be given. And ultimately, slowly, slowly you will eliminate all the methods. Because you will see the futility of all. One day, you will come to the point where you will see there is nothing to be attained, nowhere to go. That moment in Zen is called the great doubt. That moment is known in the West through Christian mystics as the dark night of the soul. It is really a dark night of the soul. The great doubt. Nothing to be attained, nowhere to go. All future disappears. You are in a kind of fog. Then who you are? Then what you are doing here? Then why this existence is? All seems meaningless if there is no attainment, if there is no way to reach, and nowhere to reach, and nobody to reach. Then what is all this? A great doubt arises. This doubt precedes Satori. This great doubt, this dark night of the soul, always precedes Satori. Either you fall back because of the doubt, you start moving again into methods, you start clinging again into methods, paths and ways, and scriptures and principles and philosophies and doctrines, you fall back. Just to avoid the doubt, you start clinging to something again. But if you are really courageous, and this is real courage, that you remain in doubt, and you don't fall back, and you don't cling to anything again, you leave yourself into this dark night of the soul, helpless, lost, utterly lost, seeing no meaning, and seeing no future. If this courage is there, Satori happens. Suddenly, out of this great doubt and the pain and the agony of it, you become awakened. A parallel exists in nightmares. You must have seen it happening again and again. If the nightmare becomes too horrible, the dream is broken. You can go on dreaming sweet dreams whole night. There is no problem. The dream is so sweet, it is like a lullaby. It keeps you drunk, intoxicated. But if the dream is horrible, you are being chased by a tiger. And the tiger is coming closer and closer and closer. And the fear. And your heart is beating fast. And your breath is no more rhythmic. And you are perspiring. and you are running and running, and there seems to be no escape. And then suddenly you see the path has ended into an abyss. There is no way to go. And the tiger is coming closer and closer. You can almost feel his breath on your back. And then his paw. And a fountain of blood rushes out of your back. Can you go on remaining asleep? The nightmare is too much. It is bound to destroy your sleep abruptly, suddenly. You are awake. It is like a sudden jump from one state of consciousness to another. One moment before you were asleep, now you are awake. There is no tiger, just your wife. And her hand on your back, and her breath, all has disappeared. The great doubt is the point where one feels the greatest nightmare, where whole life turns into a nightmare. With open eyes, when you see the whole life has lost meaning. Because life has meaning only if you have goals. When you are enchanted by goals, life has meaning. When there are no goals, meaning disappears. Suddenly, you see you don't have any ground underneath your feet. You are hanging in emptiness. You are falling like a dead leaf into some unknown bottomless pit. And it is all dark. And there is not even a ray of light. This is the work of a Zen master, to push you into this great doubt. Once this happens, Satori is bound to happen. Unless you fall back again and start dreaming sweet dreams. To be with a real master is to be in a fire. To be with a real master is to face your death, is to face your annihilation. That's why Zen is known as the sudden enlightenment. Abrupt doctrine. Hubert Benoit also says that Satori has two meanings. One is the Satori state in which everybody is, the birds and the trees and the mountains and you and all the Buddhas, past, present, future. The whole existence is in the state of Satori. This is another way of saying that God is everywhere, in everything. That God is the soul of everything. Buddhahood is everybody's nature. And the second is Satori event. Every man is from all eternity in the state of Satori. The Satori event is only that historic anecdotal instance when man suddenly ceases not recognizing that he has always been in the Satori state. You are a Buddha. When you recognize it, are when you remember it. That is Satori event. The Satori event is only a window into Satori state. And this Satori event has apparent reality only in the eyes of the man who has not yet experienced it. One who has experienced it recognizes that he has always been in Satori. That's why we cannot speak of progress, evolution, attainment, realization, etc., etc. Yoko's master Huineng says there is no accomplishment, there is no realization. And then it follows as matter of course that the efforts towards realization are all useless. Then why do Zen people make efforts just to see their futility? Slowly the futility is proved, and then one is left only with a constant question. In Zen it is called the great doubt. It precedes Satori event. The realization of Satori consists in realizing that the idea of realization is illusory, and the idea of the way to realization is illusory, because all is realization from the very beginning. It is already the case. This is the most fundamental vision of Zen. If you understand it, then Yoka, Daishis, Sodoka, the Song of Enlightenment, can be easily understood. Now the song. Do you not see him? The really wise man, always at ease, unmoved. He does not get rid of illusion, nor does he seek for the so-called truth. Ignorance is intrinsically the Buddha nature. Our illusory, unreal body is the cosmic body. Statements of immense significance. Statements of great rebellion against all orthodox religions. Statements that can shock you. Statements which we never relate with religions such as Christianity, Hinduism, Jainism, Islam. Buddhism is the highest vision possible. Do you not see him? The Buddha is within you. Do you not see him? The really wise man, always at ease, unmoved. Have you not ever experienced in yourself something that remains always unmoved? If you look, you will find. You are in pain, but something remains above it. That is your Buddha nature. You are in great misery. Just look a little deep. Just search a little deep. Dig a little deep. And you will find something hidden there which is untouched by the misery. There is great turmoil in your mind. Thoughts and thoughts, and the traffic goes on and on. It is a mad traffic. But can't you see that there is a witness to it all? A watcher on the hills? That is your reality. That is Buddha hiding in you. And it is already there. just a recognition is needed. Do you not see him, the really wise man, always at ease, unmoved? He does not get rid of illusion. There is no need to get rid of any illusion. Illusion is illusion. Knowing it as illusion is enough. There is no need to get rid of it. That's why the Zen master goes on living in the world, in the marketplace. He is not an escapist. He is not afraid of the world. He is not like the Vedantins who say the world is illusory, so we have to renounce it. Just see the ridiculousness of it. If the world is illusory, what is there to renounce? How can you renounce an illusion? And not only that, these people renounce the world, they go to the Himalayan caves, they sit there, greatly satisfied that they have renounced. What have you renounced? If it was illusory, it cannot be renounced. And if it was not illusory, then you are a fool to renounce it. Either way, it cannot be renounced. If it is real, there is no way to renounce it. There is no need either. If it is unreal, how can you renounce it? Seeing that it is illusory is enough. Seeing it, the gestalt changes. Suddenly, you are no more concerned with the illusion around you. You are centered in the witnessing consciousness. He does not get rid of illusion. Nor does he seek for the so-called truth. He is not a seeker, because the seeker lives in the future, and to live in the future is to live in desire, and to live in desire is to live in the world. This is Zen renunciation, not to live in the future, because the future is not. Not to live in desire. It does not matter whether you desire money or meditation, sansara or samadhi. What you desire makes no difference. Any object of desire will do. Desire will persist. Desire is the problem. So the real man of Zen does not seek the so-called truth. See the point. Yoko is calling it the so-called truth. All truths are so-called, because the real truth cannot be uttered. All truths are man-made. Just 2-3 days, a sannyasi wrote a letter to me, doing intensive enlightenment. He came to see that just in his belly, close to the diaphragm, there is a hard plate of steel that is dividing him into two. And because of it, he cannot be one and whole. There is only a small hole in it, through which he connects with the lower part of his body. And he was very much puzzled, because underneath the hole he saw written Made in USA. Patent applied for. Then he became very much worried. What is this? Whether you are having the steel plate Made in USA or made in India, it is all man-made. Your misery is man-made. Your suffering is man-made. You have used your creativity to produce it. you have misused your creative forces. And once you have created something in your mind, it is real. Unless you withdraw your support. All that looks real to you is real because you are supporting its reality. You go on feeding and nursing it. Withdraw your support. You need not go out of the marketplace. You can just withdraw wherever you are. And the way to withdraw it, just be a witness to it. Just see it silently, with no judgment. He does not get rid of illusion, nor does he seek for the so-called truth. Ignorance is intrinsically the Buddha nature. So don't be worried. Even if you are ignorant, don't be worried. You are still a Buddha. Just not aware. You are a rich man and you are asleep. And you dream that you have become a beggar. But you have not become a beggar. You are still rich. Your treasure is still yours. Your bank balance is yours. And in the morning when you will get up, you will not need to get rid of the beggar. And you will not need to seek the treasure. You will suddenly know that it was always there, even while you were thinking you are a beggar. This whole world is our created and sustained dream. Our illusory, unreal body is the cosmic body. And don't create any distinctions that this is unreal and that is real. All is one. Getting rid of things and clinging to emptiness is an illness of the same kind. But beware. It happens that people try to get rid of things and then they cling to emptiness. That's what the old sannyas is. Getting rid of things and then clinging to emptiness. But if you cling to emptiness, you have reduced emptiness into the biggest thing that is possible in the world. Now that is your treasure. Now that is your possession. Now you have to be very, very cautious to protect it. Just a dog barking can destroy it. A child playing and shouting can destroy it. Look at the so-called religious. Small things disturb them. Just the children playing by the side of the road and their meditation is disturbed. The wife talking a little loudly to the neighbor and their prayer is disturbed. If you have one person religious, so-called religious in your house, he will drive the whole family neurotic. This is not the way to be religious. This is really a way to dominate over people, to torture them. It is a way of becoming powerful over them in the name of religion. Daddy is meditating and the children cannot play. The wife cannot talk loudly. You cannot put the radio on. You cannot watch TV. Daddy is meditating. And he may be simply meditating to have this control. Otherwise, nobody listens to him. The wife never takes any care. And children are children. They don't bother much about the old man. But when he meditates, then the house is silent. That is his politics. Make a slight noise and he is disturbed. He is annoyed. He is angry. He is in his age. And he will take revenge. The real man of religion just becomes calm and quiet not because the situation is calm and quiet, but just because he is no more attached to anything whatsoever. He is not attached to the world, he is not attached to God. He is simply not attached. He is not hankering for the worldly things, and he is not hankering for the other worldly things. He is not hankering at all. He is at ease. Do you not see him? The really wise man, always at ease, unmoved. Getting rid of things and clinging to emptiness is an illness of the same kind. There is no difference. There are people who are very virtuous, but their virtue is a kind of currency, currency of the other world. They are hoping to live in heaven with all the pleasures and gratifications that they have denied themselves here. And they are feeling very good and very piously egoistic, seeing others being sinners, and they know deep down that these people will have to suffer in hell and for eternity. They are hoping that this happens. Do you call these people religious? Then who will be unreligious? It is the same kind of disease. Remember it always. The mind is so cunning, it can change the disease to the opposite disease, but the innermost reality remains the same. You were depending on money, you can renounce the money and you can depend on renunciation. You were thinking money is going to make you happy, now you are thinking renunciation is going to make you happy. Nothing has changed. It is the same kind of disease. It is just like throwing oneself into a fire to avoid being drowned. Now the fire and water look opposite. So if you are being drowned, you can throw yourself in fire, thinking that fire will save you. The opposite can never save you. Or you are in fire and you jump into the water and get drowned, thinking that the water will save you. The opposite cannot save you, because the opposite only appears to be the opposite. It is not. The fire and the water are in conspiracy. The world and the other world are in conspiracy. See the point and don't jump into the opposite. Just remain in the middle, a watcher, a witness, and you are out of it all. When asked, what is your religion? I answer, the power of the Makahanya. Sometimes affirming things, sometimes denying them. It is beyond the wisdom of man, sometimes with common sense, sometimes against it. Heaven cannot make head or tail of it. Yoko says, when I am asked, what is your religion? I say, Makahanya, that is the Japanese for Mahapragna. It means the great wisdom. A beautiful answer. He does not say Christianity. He does not even say Buddhism, not even Zen. He simply says the great wisdom, Mahapragna. What is this Mahapragna? Witnessing, watching, becoming more and more aware of the reality that is you. Coming to grips with your innermost core. Wisdom has not to be gathered from the outside. It is inside you. It is your innermost reality. The light is already burning there, but you are keeping it at the back. Turn about. A 180-degree turn is needed. And the sun that used to rise in the morning, it starts rising in the evening. I answer the power of Mahaprajna, the great wisdom. And what is the great wisdom? Heaven cannot make head or tail of it, because it is a spontaneity. The ordinary wise man has ready-made answers. He is a robot. He is a computer. You ask the question and the answer is already there. You push the button and the answer comes out. It is mechanical. It is not so with the great wisdom. If you ask a Christian a certain question, immediately the answer comes. He is quoting the Bible. It is not his answer. It may have been Jesus' answer, but who knows? Jesus may not have been reported rightly. Down the centuries, his message may have been corrupted. More possibility is that it has been corrupted. Thousands and thousands of interpretations. And the way he expressed it is bound to be totally different than the way we will understand it, because 20 centuries have passed. Words don't carry the same meaning anymore. A great lot has changed. So much water has gone down the Ganges. So when a Christian answers, he is simply quoting. Whatever he is saying is within inverted commas. Hence it is false. Anything that is within inverted commas is false. It is not yours. It is not authentic. And the question, you can go on asking again and again, the answer will remain the same. That is to judge. That is the way to judge it. That's how one should judge it, the criterion. If the answer remains the same in different situations, then the answer is mechanical. You ask in the morning and the answer is same. And you ask in the afternoon and the answer is same. And you ask in the evening and the answer is same. Because the answer is ready-made. It is just a gramophone record. You push the button, it plays. It is a tape. But great wisdom is totally different. And the most distinguishing thing about it is its spontaneity. In the morning it is one thing, in the afternoon another. And by the evening nobody knows. Even heaven cannot make head or tail of it. Why? Because it is so spontaneous. So utterly of the moment. It is a response. Sometimes affirming things. You ask the Buddha, is there God? And sometimes he says, yes. What else? Only God is. And you ask the Buddha another day, is there God? And he says, no, never heard. What nonsense you are talking about? God? And the third time you ask him, is there God? And he closes his eyes and sits silent, answering not at all. Or the fourth time you ask him about God and he says something about something else. Not talking about God at all. He talks about something else. He responds to the question. In fact, more to the questioner than to the question. He responds to the totality, the context of the question and the questioner, the mood, the climate. It is not a ready-made phenomenon. Sometimes affirming things. So this is the criterion of judging the great wisdom. It is never mechanical, it is never repetitive. Sometimes affirming things, sometimes denying them. It is always inconsistent. It is only consistent in its inconsistencies. Because life is so. It has no fixed ideas to propound. It is like a mirror. A monkey comes before the mirror and the monkey is reflected. And a donkey comes before the mirror and the donkey is reflected. And you come before the mirror in anger and anger is reflected. And you come before the mirror in great love and joy and love and joy is reflected. The mirror has no ideas how things should be. The mirror allows freedom. So whatsoever is, the mirror reflects. Sometimes affirming things, sometimes denying them. It is beyond the wisdom of man. The great wisdom is beyond your so-called wisdom. The wisdom of man. The wisdom of man is very consistent. It is never self-contradictory. It keeps to a particular line. It is linear. It is one-dimensional. Hence, it is false, because life is multidimensional. Life is many things together. Life is all things together. Life is paradoxical. The great wisdom is paradoxical. Remember it. Whenever you come across a person who is very consistent, know well that he is a philosopher, but not a wise man. He has a philosophy, a system, in which he has become obsessed, fixed, rooted. A wise man is a flux, a river life. A philosopher is frozen, like ice. That's why philosophy is cold. Religion is warm. It has the warmth of love. Because it flows. It goes on flowing. It is a movement. It is alive. It is beyond the wisdom of man, sometimes with common sense, sometimes against it. The great wisdom sometimes agrees with the common sense and sometimes is absolutely against it. There is no way of deciding how the really wise man will respond. There is no way of predicting. He remains unpredictable. This should be the criterion of how to find a master. If you can find a man who lives in paradox and yet in poise. Who lives in paradox yet utterly calm. Do you not see him? The really wise man always at ease, unmoved. Who lives but with no ideas how to live. Who simply lives, who innocently lives, and who is like a mirror, reflecting all that passes by, who does not project anything, but only reflects, who does not act on life, but is only receptive. A really wise man is feminine, receptive, passive. That's why Buddha looks so feminine. that quality of passiveness, that quality of receptivity. He is just a receptacle. He reflects life. He allows life to reflect in him, to be reflected through him. He sings the song that existence wants to sing through him. He has no ideas of his own. He does not hinder. This song is also a song of Mahapragya. This is one of the most beautiful songs ever sung, because there is no singer in it. Because the song has sung itself. Enough for today.